I'm Brett.
And I'm Alice.
And we are the Prosecutors. Today on The Prosecutors, Darlie Routier made a desperate 911 call to report that her two oldest boys had been stabbed and her own throat cut. So her family and neighbors were shocked when she was arrested for the crime. But did the police get it right? Everybody, and welcome to this episode of The Prosecutors. I'm Brett, and I'm joined, as always, with my entrancing co-host, Alice.
Wow, entrancing. Who gave you that one?
You know, I think Claire, maybe? No, it wasn't Claire.
You know, some people might disagree with Claire or whoever thinks Jane. I'm entrancing because, what did someone recently say? It's, our relationship is so forced. I'm sorry, Brett, that
no,
our relationship is so
we
forced.
We have a forced relationship. Yeah, if only we had better chemistry, Alice. It was a very nice review that person left, so I don't want to be too mean to them.
Oh, I'm not being mean. Funny. I'm just surprised that, you know, I really try not to let on how much it's forced that I pretend to like you is all.
I know. Because I just like you so intensely. And I thought we were doing a better job hiding it for the good of the show, you know. But we're like Patrick Swayze and what's her name? Oh God.
Jennifer Grey.
In Dirty Dancing. You know, they didn't like each other very much. But, you couldn't tell watching the movie. Great movie, if you haven't seen it.
It's a fantastic movie. sorry, yes. I was just envisioning my like old tired body trying to do that dance lift. And it was just a funny image in my mind.
If we seem a little loopy today, Alice is on a plane at 5 a.m., so she could fly back to record this episode. So
it's actually
give her some credit.
But please, please, Brett, you're up all hours of the night, still going to the hospital to visit your baby boy. How is he doing?
He's doing very well. You guys will be hearing this like 3 weeks after we record it, so we'll have to give you some interim updates. But he's doing very well. Just briefly, he's actually moved out of the NICU now to sort of the level below that, still receiving a lot of care, sort of constant attention by the doctors, but one level below where he was, which is a really good thing. And a lot of the tubes and stuff that were connected to him are no longer connected to him, and he's doing a lot of stuff on his own that he could not do before. So we are very, very thankful, very blessed, very blessed. Thank you to everyone who's reached out, everybody who's been offering prayers and good thoughts and good energy. We really appreciate it, and you guys are awesome. So with that, I think we should introduce our case for today. As we said in the introduction, we are going to be talking about one of the most controversial cases in true crime. I'll tell you that a couple things. I'm going to lay a couple little foundational bits for you guys. Don't know how many episodes this is going to be. Our outline is 10,000 words long, which is the longest outline by far that we've ever had. We're going to try and rein in some of the side commentary to keep this moving. But those of you who know this case understand why there is so much detail. This is a controversial case, a case that resulted in a controversial trial, and that has inspired a lot of discussion for the last, man, I don't even know. I guess it's been 25 years now. And I will tell you, I will make two promises to you. Number one is we will reach a conclusion at the end of this. And number two, we will make some people angry. So that is our promise to you. However we're going to come out on this, we know it's going to make some people angry, and we are fine with that. We always shoot you straight on this podcast, and we are interested to hear what you think about our views on this case, and we're interested to hear your views on this case. But let's go ahead and get started, because we'll never finish if we don't. So as we said earlier, we are taking you back to June of 1996. At that time, 26-year-old Darlie Routier seemed to live the perfect life in her home in Rowlett, Texas, a suburb of Dallas. Alice, are you familiar with Rowlett and all? Is that
part of Texas? Of course I know Rowlett. We played football against them, which meant I was on the dance team. So, you know, a little bit of competition with their dance team. But yes, it's a, the Texas town close to Dallas and a pretty typical suburb town.
I think it's on a lake, if I remember correctly. So, nice place. Nice place to live. Nice place to raise your family. And that's what she was doing with her husband, Darren, and her three kids, Devin, age 6, Damon, age 5, and Drake, 7 months. A lot of D names. We will do our best to keep them straight for you. But on the night of June 6, 1996, that all changed. According to Darlie, a man entered her home while she and her oldest sons were sleeping downstairs. He grabbed a knife from the block in the kitchen and viciously stabbed the boys to death before cutting Darlie's throat. She barely survived this attack, with the blade coming within 2 millimeters of cutting her carotid artery. And yet, that's not the scene that the police saw. They saw a staged scene. One victim, whose wounds, while severe, were not as severe as the other two, and a story that didn't seem to make sense to them. It wasn't long before Darlie was arrested, tried, and convicted for murdering her two sons. But to this day, people wonder, did the jury get it right?
So, Brett, let's jump into the timeline. It's not too long. It all happens basically within a few hours. So let's go to June 6th, 1996. At 12:30 or 1 a.m., Darren Routier, Darlie's husband, leaves his wife and his two oldest boys downstairs while he goes upstairs to go to sleep in the master bedroom. The baby is asleep in his crib, also in the master bedroom. At about 1:30 in the morning, Mary Rickles, a woman who lived near the Routiers, is watching a horror movie. She described herself as a, quote, big horror movie freak. When she
My kind of woman.
I was going to say, it sounds like she would really like your Martyrs episode. When Mary hears someone at her door, she thinks it's her husband, but soon comes to believe that someone is trying to break in. So she turns on the porch light because she is a brave woman. I would have run the other way. And sees two men on the porch. One was wearing a knit cap and a jogging suit. The other was wearing a cowboy hat. Once she had turned on the porch lights, the two men ran away. And instead of calling anyone, she just goes back to watching television.
Which is amazing.
And watching that. A horror movie at that.
I love this woman's testimony. Her testimony in the trial was great.
Yeah, she's incredible. About half an hour later or so, 1:45 a.m. to 2 a.m., Rickles hears a sound at her bedroom window. And when she turned on the light, she saw the men at her window this time. Once again, they left, and this time they did not return. They ran off in the general direction of Eagle Drive, where the Routiers lived, about a half mile away. Rickles thinks this is about 2:08 a.m. 5 days later, Rickles will tell the police about this incident. And note that she didn't tell the police that night. Man, if two men came to my porch and then came to my bedroom window twice in one night at in the middle of the night, I'd be screaming and calling the police. But everyone's different, and she did not. But she did eventually tell the police, and she testified at trial.
Yeah, and she has no reason to lie, but yeah, this is a story. If you heard it from somebody who was like a suspect, for instance, you wouldn't believe it, right? Like, you would never believe that somebody who's watching horror movies in the middle of the night has two randos trying to break into her front door and then trying to break into her bedroom through the window. And she's just like, oh, well, you know.
I got
that's
them.
That's Rowlett for you, I guess.
Actually, I was going to say, that's very like Wild West Texas, right? I got my guns. I can protect my house. We're good. Let's keep going. I don't feel like, you know, staying up later. But it's at around 2:31 a.m. Darley calls 911 to report the attacks. January 6, 1997, Darley's trial begins. So you can see a lot of the timeline actually has to do with Mary Rickles, this, you know, half mile away neighbor's testimony about what she observed at her house. And then you can see kind of where the story is being drawn with respect to her testimony.
Yeah, it's a pretty tight little timeline here. We know from both Darren and Darley that, you know, no later than 1 a.m., they're going to sleep. And then she calls 911 at 2:31. I mean, honestly, that could be your timeline. We included the Mary Rickles stuff because it is important and it's something people talk about when they consider whether or not there was an intruder who was a part of this. But yeah, a tight timeline, not a lot of time for things to happen. That's going to become something that's important. We're about to discuss it, as a matter of fact. One thing I did want to address briefly, the murder occurs on June 6th. Her trial starts on January 6th, 1997, so 6 months later. It's interesting because people will criticize that because it's fast. That's a really quick turnaround for a murder trial. And it's led some people to believe that Darley didn't get a fair trial. And I would just note that the defense really picks when a trial happens. The prosecution has some say, but if the defense says we can't be ready in 6 months, there's not going to be a trial in 6 months. The defendant has the right to a speedy trial. It's actually in the Constitution. Many states and the federal government have statutes that protect that right. So normally, it's kind of on the defendant. If the defendant wants a fast trial, they'll get a fast trial. If they need more time, they'll get more time. Why Darley's defense wanted to move this quickly, I don't know. Sometimes that's a strategic decision. Because when you have a complex case and all you have to do is poke holes in what the prosecution is trying to show, it puts a lot of pressure on the prosecution to try and put together a case in such a short time period.
Right. And it also cuts off any sort of investigation because the prosecution kind of has to limit what they investigate and turn to trial prep.
Yeah. And some people talk about the, you know, the physical evidence and evidence that wasn't tested before trial. Some of that might be just because this went so quickly. And you could imagine why the defense wouldn't necessarily want that tested, because it's not necessarily going to come back favorably for the defendant.
That's a great point, Brett. I've waited much longer than 6 months for drug analysis, fingerprint analysis, blood analysis. So this is completely in line with what you were saying, that 6 months is actually a very short amount of time turnaround for forensic testing.
So there's one thing we want to address right at the outset of this case, because so many people who look at this case, this becomes something they focus on. Now, the way we did this, we started on this case. This is not a case, frankly, I knew anything about before we started this. I'd heard we got tons of requests for this case. Everybody wanted to hear about this case. A lot of people have covered it. And finally, we decided we were going to do it. And the way we did it, there's a lot of information online. There are pro-Darley sites and anti-Darley sites, and they link to things like the trial transcript, photographs, autopsy reports, all the things you need to really dive into this case. So that's what we did. We looked at that. We looked at trial transcript. We looked at really all the sort of physical evidence, the reports on the evidence, expert reports, all that kind of stuff. Wrote up an outline, and then, only then, really started listening to what other people had said, podcasts, reading articles on this. And one of the things that a lot of people focus on is whether or not Darley had enough time to commit these crimes. There are some things about these crimes that, as we continue to discuss this, will become more and more important to you. Remember, you have two dead people in this home. You have Darley saying there was an intruder. In a lot of ways, this is very similar to Jeffrey McDonald. There's only one or two things happened. And they actually discuss this in trial. Darley testifies in her own defense at trial. And the prosecutor asked her this question. Was one or two things happened, right? Like either you killed your kids or this intruder did it. And that's absolutely right. One of those two things happened. And the scene, there are things about the scene. There's evidence that if Darley did it, there are things that she staged. There are a few things. There's a cut screen, which would be the way an intruder entered if it was an intruder. There's, you know, some blood evidence. There's some minor signs of a struggle. There's a sock. And this is one of the this is one of the things that makes this case kind of crazy. There's a sock that's found two doors down in an alleyway that has blood on it that's from the boys. So whoever did this, whether it was an intruder or Darlie, there was some blood on this sock, and either the intruder left the sock there or dropped the sock, or Darlie planted the sock. One of those things happened. And the question people ask is, based on the fact that Darlie, the sock has the blood of the boys on it, and you have this 911 call, a 911 call, by the way, which lasted 6 minutes, could Darlie have pulled this off? And those who believe in Darlie's innocence often claim that she did not have time to accomplish all the things she needed to accomplish in the short period of time she had. And this theory typically goes like this. Whatever actions Darlie took, from cleaning up to stabbing herself to planting the sock, all had to happen after the boys were stabbed. After all, the sock has blood from both boys on it. At some point, she calls the paramedics, and that 911 call lasts for 5 minutes and 44 seconds. When the paramedics arrive, it took a couple minutes for them to enter the house. So Darlie's defenders will say that Damon, who is the younger boy, could only have survived for 9 minutes after he was stabbed. Since he was alive when the paramedics found him, this only leaves a little over a minute, maybe a minute 30 total, for Darlie to do the thing she needed to do between the stabbing and calling 911. So he can live 9 minutes. The 911 call lasts 5 minutes and 44 seconds. It takes 2 minutes for the paramedics to get in. That's where the minute 30 comes.
So we are working under a very tight timeline, but there are a couple problems with this claim. For one, it is possible that Damon was finished off later, but we'll come back to this point. Let's just focus first on the 9 minutes. Where does this 9 minutes come from? Routier's defense counsel was effective in poking holes in the prosecution case, and it was this defense that created the timeline in cross-examination of the medical examiner who performed the autopsy on Damon, Dr. Janice Townsend Parchman. But the problem is, the medical examiner didn't actually say how Damon could have only survived 9 minutes. On direct, she stated that he would not have died immediately, but he could have only survived for, quote, minutes. Now, on cross-examination, the defense tried to tie down Dr. Townsend Parchman on exactly how long Damon could have lived. I'm going to read you the questioning that happened on cross-examination so you can see how this 9 minutes number comes into essentially lore of this case. Question. Okay, so from the time that he received all of these injuries, he could have lasted as little as 2 or 3 minutes or as much as maybe 5 or 6 minutes, something like that? Yes. Okay. Then the doctor says, even conceivably a little bit longer. The defense counsel asks, maybe as much as 8 or 9 minutes? The doctor says, you can't tell. As you can see, the doctor doesn't say that Damon could have only lived 9 minutes. In fact, she says it's impossible to tell exactly how long he could have lived. He could have lived as little as 2 minutes, or he could have lived for more. If the attorney had asked if he could have lived 10 or 11 minutes or 12 or 13 or 15 minutes, the doctor probably would have said, sure, it's possible. But obviously, at some point, survival becomes unlikely. But how long any person will survive after a wound is not an exact science. Now, this is really important because we have said before how cross-examination is an art. And essentially, what the defense counsel or whoever's doing cross-examination wants to do is the attorney wants to be testifying. And that's what happened here. The 9 minutes came out of the mouth of the defense attorney. It never came out of the mouth of the doctor who's being cross-examined.
Yeah, and if he had said, instead of maybe as much as 8 or 9 minutes, if he'd said maybe as much as 7 or 8 minutes, she probably would have said the same thing. You can't tell. And then the lore would be he could only have lived for 8 minutes. So the defense attorney did a good job stopping here because it was getting longer and longer, and he didn't want it to get any longer because he this was his whole theory, right? I mean, he's establishing this. It's impossible for her to have done it. She didn't have enough time. She couldn't have done it. And so he's smart to stop at 8 or 9 minutes and not keep going because the doctor is clearly getting closer and closer to saying this is impossible to say. Not an hour. You know, it is a matter of minutes, but it's hard to say exactly how long. And this has entered this story, the lore, as Alice said, as a definitive thing, like 9 minutes, as if it were scientific, as if Damon were a machine and, you know, there was a clock counting down on him from 9 minutes, and that's how long he had. And that's just not the case.
No. I mean, I want to read that question back to you just so you know exactly where that 9 minutes came from. The question was, maybe as much as 8 or 9 minutes? The answer is, you can't tell. There is no affirmation of the 8 or 9 minutes right there. So remember, this estimation was based on the theory that Damon was stabbed all at one time. On redirect, the doctor was asked if Damon would have lived longer if he were stabbed once, and then the remaining stab wounds occurred later. The doctor said that he would have. And so that kind of throws a wrench into the short timeline again, because the short timeline is assuming all the stabs happened at one time, and then he expired from those, you know, the culmination of all of those stab wounds at once.
And when we look at the blood evidence in this case later, there is evidence that it might have happened that way, and that also kind of throws this whole timeline thing out. There's another interesting thing about this, though, that I'll admit is speculation in a lot of ways, but that I thought was interesting as I was reading through the testimony in this case. And I have a question about whether Damon was actually alive when the paramedics arrived. Now, this is speculative, we admit that. But if you look at the testimony from the paramedics, there is some question about this. It is much less clear that Damon was alive when the paramedics arrived. So here's what paramedic Colby said. That was a paramedic who arrived on the scene. And I'll read you the question and answer, much like Alice did. You say that you turned him over. Is that right? I rolled him over. Yes, sir. Okay. And what, if anything, occurred when you rolled the child over? He gasped for a gasp of air, and that was the final time that he breathed. When he gasped, did you notice whether or not his eyes were open? Yes, sir. His eyes were open, and there was still a little light of life in those eyes. Did you ever see that light go out of his eyes? Yes, sir. As I was with the child, it slowly faded. Okay. So the proof that Damon is alive at this point is based on him taking his final breath when he's turned over by the paramedic and the light fading from his eyes. So no pulse was taken, no other indication to show that Damon was alive. One breath and fading light. And I think there are some of you out there who are first responders, who are paramedics, who listen to this show, and I think you may be seeing the potential problem here, and I would be interested to hear from you after we do this episode. So the paramedic only noticed the single breath when he turned over Damon, but there is a common and weird thing that happens when someone dies. Significant movement of the body, which turning over is actually the most common, can result in the body taking one final breath. In reality, this is just the body expelling residual air that's still in the lung or in the windpipe, but it can be very convincing. And it can even cause the body to seem to moan or groan. And it's so common that paramedics and other first responders are often told not to move the body, not to turn the body over in front of family. You can imagine the reaction a family member might have to seeing their relative, who they have been told is dead, suddenly breathe. Now, it's impossible to know whether or not that's what the paramedic witnessed. Maybe this was Damon's final breath that he just so happened to take as the paramedic was turning him over. And of course, there's the whole light in the eyes statement, whatever that means, and for whatever it's worth. But it certainly seems possible that Damon was not actually alive at this point. And there is evidence pointing in that direction. First, one of the officers that had responded to this testified that he had heard sounds coming from the boy indicating he was dying before his eyes, essentially a death rattle. Once again, those of you who are first responders, police officers, you've probably heard this. This would have been several minutes before the paramedics arrived. The police officers got there first. They entered the home, took the paramedics a little while to get there. The paramedics actually had to wait outside while the police officers cleared the scene. Then the paramedics were allowed in. So you have this officer saying Damon was already dying when he arrives there. Doesn't really fit necessarily with him still being alive when the paramedic shows up. The other thing that's really interesting is the paramedics didn't take Damon's pulse, but Darren, Darlie's husband and Damon's father, did, and he could not find one. In fact, his statement that he gave to the police mentions not once, but twice, that when he checked on Damon, he did not have a pulse. So, look, a lot has been made of this timeline. It's certainly an interesting factor in this case, but I think it's been given way more weight than it deserves. Number one, because it's a little misleading, and number two, because it may be based on a faulty premise. But one thing I would note, because once again, this is a case where people talk about not only is Darlie guilty, but did she have a fair trial? All of this discussion about the timeline and the fact that did Darlie have time to commit this crime, that was all put on for the jury. The jury was aware of this argument and would have found her guilty, believing the 9-minute timeline is basically correct, but that she nevertheless committed these crimes. So it's not the case that this is something the jury never heard.
Right. They got to weigh for themselves kind of this potentially conflicting timeline. Another interesting aspect of this case is Darlie's statement to the police. In a written statement to the police given only a few days after the incident, Darlie said that after a night of watching television, she decided to spend the night in her living room with the two older boys. She wrote in her statement, quote, "I had been sleeping on the couch the past week or so, off and on, because the baby slept in our room in the crib, and when he moved, he woke me up." She states that she falls asleep, and then she continued, and she wrote, quote, "After a while, I started to get sleepy. The next thing, I wake up, and I feel pressure on me. I felt Damon press on my right shoulder and heard him cry. This made me really come awake and realize there was a man standing down at my feet, walking away from me. I walked after him and heard glass breaking. I got halfway through the kitchen and turned back around to run and turn on the light. I ran back towards the utility room and realized there was a big white-handled knife lying on the floor. It was then that I realized I had blood all over me, and I grabbed the knife thinking he was in the garage, so I thought he might still be there, and I yelled for Darren. I ran back through the kitchen and realized the entire living area had blood all over everything. I put the knife on the counter and ran into the entrance, turned on a light, and started screaming for Darren. I think I screamed twice, and he ran out of the bedroom with his jeans on and no glasses and was yelling, 'What is it? What is it?'" Now, the remainder of her statement is about the police and paramedics arriving. Now, this statement will hang around Darlie's neck forever. By the way, that is not a very long statement at all in terms of describing what happened that night. I just read you basically her whole statement about what happened that night, and it doesn't tell you very much.
Yeah. And the actual statement, I mean, like Alice said, if you look at the statement, and we're going to link to several of these websites that have this, The introduction, which talks about everything before this, including her sister comes over. I think it was her sister. It might have been Darren's sister comes over, and they talk about work and they watch television. And then Darren and her sit in the living room and they talk about their boat and they talk about some other things. I mean, it's longer than this. Obviously, now what happens after this, you know, arguably is just as important, but it talks about how, you know, the boys had been stabbed. She got a towel. She put the towel to her neck because she realized she'd had her neck cut. She put a towel on one of the boys. She called 911. She's waiting for them to arrive. They arrive. They take her to the hospital. She, you know, goes into surgery. She wakes up and she gives a statement. Is essentially what she says. And Alice is right. The description of what happened in these key moments is very short and was one of the first things that made the police wonder, is this true? Because, as you can see, very little description of this person who's supposedly in the home. I mean, this description that she gives here, and as we discuss this case, we'll discuss her sort of more detail that she gave later. There's nothing about this man. I mean, a man is the only description of this person.
And by the way, you have to remember, she's being called in after this she's lost her two children. She's just had her throat sliced open. She almost died. The purpose of this statement is to try to help the cops catch the person who did this to her family and to herself, right? So it's really important to give facts to help the police catch them. And notice there's just no description to help the police find anyone.
And sometimes people, you know, people are like, oh, you know, they should have waited longer. She just came out of surgery. But the whole idea is, as soon as possible, they want to talk to the victim. They want to get as much information as possible, like Alice said. The more time that ticks away, the less likely you are to find the person who did it. They also need to compare her statement against Darren's. They wait, you know, they wait until she can give a statement to get one from Darren because they don't want any, you know, collusion between the two if they're somehow involved. So you take the two statements at the same time. One person in one room, one person in the other. But yeah, in this statement, some of the things she says are going to conflict with a lot of the evidence that the police are seeing. Over the course of these episodes that we're going to do, we're going to keep coming back to this statement. We're going to come back to it again and again and talk about some of the things about the statement that don't necessarily seem to line up with what the police are saying. And let's talk about just some of the initial contradictions and maybe strange things in the statement that even just looking at the statement, I think you're probably already recognizing. We've touched on some of these, but I think the biggest one and the one that really just jumps out to you and you can't help but have this jump out to you, and it's something the prosecution focused on a lot in the cross-examination of Darlie, is a very simple question. If this happened the way she described it, how did she not wake up until it was over? So Darlie says she's sleeping downstairs because she's such a light sleeper that the baby merely turning over is enough to wake her. But she managed to sleep through an intruder entering her house, finding a knife, entering the family room, stabbing not only her children, but her without waking her up.
And she doesn't say anything about taking a sleeping pill or any sort of drugs that would affect her ability to wake up.
Right. And we're going to get to the drugs she was taking later on. And the only thing she was on were diet pills, which are not known to cause that kind of symptom. If anything, they cause the opposite.
They're caffeine.
And Darlie, yeah, exactly. And Darlie has no explanation for this. And if you read the cross-examination, I guess if she's telling the truth, she does what she has to do. She says, I don't know how I didn't wake up. And it's really difficult. It's really difficult to understand how this is possible. And those who believe in Darlie's innocence really have to jump through some hoops to try and address this. I think one of the most popular things people claim is that Darlie probably did wake up and maybe even fought with this attacker, was stabbed. And then the trauma made her pass out and forget the whole thing. And so this is sort of a flip on what Darlie says. Darlie says the kids are stabbed first, then she's stabbed, then she wakes up. You know, and so this idea is, well, maybe she was attacked first, and because of the trauma, she's forgotten the whole thing. And the second time she wakes up is the first time that she remembers, if that makes sense. But if this extraordinary course of events were true, why does she say that she woke up on the couch and not somewhere else? Presumably, if she's struggling with this intruder, it would have taken place sort of all over the room, right? And it's weird that she was sleeping on the couch. She wakes up on the couch. If you believe that she got into a fight, she would have had to have fallen back onto the couch, which is kind of a strange thing. You also have to wonder just how long she was out before she woke up again. And if she were out for some time, then we're kind of drawn back to this timeline. To the extent the timeline is accurate, she couldn't have been asleep for very long because, according to her, Damon's definitely awake when she wakes up the second time. And not only is he awake, but he's standing up, he's putting pressure on her, and he's talking. He's saying, like, mommy, mommy. I don't know if she says that in this statement, but yeah, heard him cry. And later on, she says that what he cries is like, mommy, mommy. So, you know, he's alive enough to stand up and talk at this point. And if she did engage in this titanic struggle with her attacker, and once again, she doesn't say she did, but this is what her defenders say to try and figure out what exactly is going on here. It's weird that she didn't wake her husband up. You know, I mean, one thing you notice about that statement, Alice, you know, if tomorrow you were asleep on the couch and you woke up and there was a man standing at the foot of your couch, what would you do?
Scream at the top of my lungs for my husband.
Yeah, exactly. That's, I mean, I would scream at the top of my lungs for my wife, you know.
To anyone to help
you. She's much more likely to be able to take the guy, right? Yeah, if anybody to help you. And she doesn't do that. Number one, we know she didn't do it because he didn't wake up. So even if this, you know, initial attack occurred, she did not scream and nothing that happened during that attack woke him up. But the other weird thing is, even in her statement, she doesn't scream for him until, you know, she's gotten up, she's followed the guy, she's turned back around because the lights are off, turned the lights on, walked into the utility room, picked up the knife, and only then does she scream for her husband, which is also, to me at least, strange.
Right. In her statement, it seems that it's not the intruder that makes her want to yell for her husband. It's only after she sees that there's blood. But I'd be just as scared with someone in my house because I assume they want to do me harm.
Yeah, absolutely. And she's obviously worried about him because she's following.
I mean, maybe she's like Mary Rickles and, you know, is ready to fight. But that, Texas, I mean, that Texas truly, woman. Especially if you're in a state of confusion, why would you follow him? But.
And your boys, I mean, you'd want to protect your kids, right? So I would think you would like get your kids and sort of like a mother hen, kind of put them behind you. You know what I mean? Not go after the guy necessarily.
Absolutely. Because she doesn't know at this point that there's not more than one person.
Right. She has no idea what's going on.
Now, we've touched on this a little bit. Why couldn't Darlie describe her attacker? Darlie gives no details about the man that she says was in her house. She doesn't say whether he's white, black, Hispanic, short, tall, slight build, overweight. Nothing. The only detail she gives initially is that the man was wearing a baseball cap and jeans. And yet, at other times, she told witnesses that she thought she knew the man. She told one of her friends that he loomed over her, rubbing the knife on her face. She told another person that he was white and overweight. Now, at trial, she said this man was over 6 feet tall with long, dark hair that went down to his collar. All of this, you know, it's all inconsistent, and also none of it's in her statement, which is very confusing.
You know, when you get a statement from somebody and it keeps changing, particularly on really important things, you expect some changes. In fact, if you don't get some changes, you get suspicious that it's overly rehearsed. But this is like the main thing, you know? I mean, what does this guy look like? Did you see the guy or not? Do you know the guy? I mean, this story about him looming over her and rubbing the knife on her face is completely different from her other story. I will note one thing. You know, she's been consistent with this whole baseball cap and jeans thing. Think back to Mary Rickles, the Mary Rickles intruders. Neither one of them were wearing either of these things. You had a knit cap, tracksuit. You had a guy wearing a cowboy hat. So, you know, already those guys don't sound like they fit the profile. Also, there's two of them, and right now we only have one person. Now look, Darlie was, you know, she was attacked, her throat was cut, she was losing blood, her children were killed. There's obviously some trauma here. I think she can be forgiven for not necessarily remembering everything and for confusing some details and for getting some things wrong. But it is strange that she remembers so little about the man that she she claims at different times to have seen.
And here's the thing. Remember, it's not like it's your one shot to give a statement to the police. Let's say she did just come out of surgery. She's under a lot of trauma and she gives the statement that she gave. And then a week later, she wakes up in a panic and says, oh my goodness, I just remembered. He was looming over me and he was rubbing the knife on my face. You can go back to the police and say, I just remembered something. We have that happen not infrequently. Now, if your story keeps changing, that becomes suspect. But it's not like the police will say, no, 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 you gave your definitive statement. That is it. We can't take any more evidence. You know, case closed. That's not how it works. So it's even though she's telling other people, she's not telling the police this. So it depends who she's talking to is how she describes this man. And that is suspect.
And the knife story she actually told to a friend in the hospital, I think the day after. She was there. She told her friend this story, and her friend testified at trial about this. So, yeah, this is really early on in the process. It's not even like something she came up with much further down the line.
And, you know, there's so many inconsistencies with her statement, but let's talk about blood. You know, Darlie says that her throat was cut on the couch while she was asleep, and yet there was almost no blood on the couch where the upper half of her body would have been. So, you know, why wasn't there more blood where her head would have been on that couch? It's not very consistent. Remember, because she says she's walking away, and it's not until she looks down and realizes that she's already been stabbed. So she doesn't remember being cut or stabbed, and she said she woke up on the couch. So the only place... The place that should have had a lot of blood was where she woke up because she was already cut at that point. But there wasn't.
And there's blood all over the place in this scene. If you guys check out the websites we're going to share with you, you will see that. You know, her shirt had blood all over it. I mean, she bled a good bit. So it is strange. I mean, and I go back to the story. You know, she gets in a fight with the person. Maybe he cuts her throat somewhere else, but she has to fall back onto that couch. I mean, she has to end up on the couch bleeding. So you would think there'd be more blood there, and yet there's just not. Another question that's interesting is why did Damon end up where he did? According to Darlie's story, she awakes to Damon pressing on her shoulder and crying. But Damon's body wasn't found near the couch. In fact, he was found near the entrance of the family room. We're going to include a diagram that was done of this. And so you can see where Damon ends up. If you look at this diagram, it's a diagram of the house. You can see where he ends up. He essentially ends up kind of like there's an entrance to this family room that opens up into the kitchen. And then there's a hallway that goes to the entryway. And he's kind of at the intersection of those various places in the home. So how did he end up there if he's been stabbed, presumably where he's sleeping? He then wakes up Darlie. So did he awaken Darlie and then crawl away from her? And if so, why would he do that? Now, Darlie, later on, not in her initial statement, but later on will give sort of an explanation of why this happened when she sort of expands her initial statement. Some people would say to cover the things that she's learned about the crime, the things that she needs to figure out a way to explain. And what she will say is that Damon not only wakes her up, but he actually follows her out of the room as she is going after this attacker. He essentially reaches the point where his body ends up and she tells him, stay here, and he does. But the question you got to ask is, could he have done that with the wounds he suffered? We're going to talk about his wounds later, but I believe he has 4 stab wounds. He may not have that many, but he's got several stab wounds going through his lungs. I mean, these are, you know, really, really bad stab wounds. And could he have done that? I mean, could he have gotten up and walked after her and talked to her while he's doing that? But you know, maybe he could have, but it does make you wonder, sort of a sad thing. If she did this, it's possible. Remember, she's got to kill 2 people. You've got the 2 boys who are there. Damon is the youngest, not by much. I mean, these are pretty close kids. Damon is 5. Devin is 6 when he dies, but he's only a week away from being 7. you could imagine Darley killed Devin first because he's the oldest. Maybe Damon gets away. Maybe she chases him. Maybe she stabs him where he is. And then later on, he wakes up. He's not dead. He starts crawling away from his mother, away from this family room, sort of in a desperate attempt to escape, heading towards the doorways. And that's why he's crawling where he is. And at that point, he's stabbed again, which finishes him off. And that goes back to what we were talking about earlier with the timeline. It's possible that he was stabbed at two different times. And that's why he ends up where he does.
That would be so sad if that is what happened. But it is confusing based on Sir's statement why Damon is where he is. And I know we've talked a little bit about blood evidence, but there is just more inconsistency with that. Remember, Darley claimed in her statement that the intruder dropped the knife on his way out the garage, but crime scene techs found no blood consistent with a bloody knife being dropped in the location where Darley claimed it would be. They did, however, find outlines of the knife at various places around the house, including about 18 inches from Devin's body. If it were an intruder, we'd have to believe that he put down the knife after stabbing the kids, but before stabbing the one person who posed a threat to him. The adult in the room, Darley. So this just suggests that this knife, because of the outlines, the knife was set down. And usually an attacker is probably not going to put down their weapon, especially if the person who, if they haven't finished incapacitating all the threats of people who could rebel against him.
And as you sort of walk through what's going on here, if you're imagining the intruder scenario is what happened, you got to think that this person, for whatever reason, decided to go ahead and kill the kids and then go after Darley. And what you would think would happen, I mean, imagine this is someone who wants to rape her. This is somebody with a sexual assault is their motive. And they come in, and so they want to kill the kids, so they'll have Darley all to themselves. You would imagine they quickly kill the kids and then move on to Darley. It's strange if that's what they were trying to do, that they then attack her. That doesn't really make sense. And they just sort of attack her and then leave. And if they just wanted to murder everybody, if killing everybody was their purpose, then it's weird that they would attack Darley last because she's the most dangerous person. It's certainly strange that they would ever put that knife down in that room before Darley is incapacitated. You would keep the knife until that point. And look, yeah, I mean, Darley, her story, we know that as the killer is leaving through the utility room, he did not kneel down and gently place the knife on the floor. He's trying to get out of there. If he's going to leave the knife behind because he doesn't want to take it with him, he's just going to drop it. But when you look at the blood around the knife, it doesn't line up with that. There's none of the indications you would expect of someone dropping a knife. So you essentially have to believe that when he did this, he sort of gently place the knife on the ground, and that he did that while Darley's still alive. Not only still alive, but following him. He's leaving this knife behind for her to pick up, which is exactly what she says she did. So the next thing about her statement, we didn't read you this part, but in her statement, after she describes the attack, she claims that she lays a towel on Damon's back, which you would sort of expect, right? I mean, somebody, your child's been stabbed, they're bleeding, you want to apply pressure, you want to stop the bleeding. Now, Darley doesn't say that she applied pressure, but she does say that she lays this towel on Damon's back. And Darren will later testify to the same thing. And if you think that Darley did this, then you also probably think that at some point, Darren just starts adjusting his story to help Darley. And you see that in several places where that's a possibility. It's also possible that he's just testifying truthfully. And he does say that she lays this towel on Damon's back. The problem is the first responders didn't see a towel. So first responder Waddle testifies that when he enters the home, there's no towel on Damon's back. And in fact, he told Darley to get some towels to stop the bleeding. This is a police officer. He then goes and checks the garage for the intruder because that's where Darley's telling him the intruder went into the garage. No one doesn't see anybody in the garage, so he comes back. And when he returns, Darlie still hasn't moved. And there are no towels on Damon. So he tells her again to get some towels. And here's what he says. Question, what did she do? Answer, nothing. She kept telling me that when she chased the suspect across the kitchen, he'd dropped the knife and she'd picked up the knife and brought it back and sat it on the counter. And she told me she thought she'd messed up the fingerprints, which obviously struck this officer as very strange.
Absolutely. Your kid is bleeding out right in front of you.
Right.
You're worried about how your fingerprints have smeared something as if you're coming up with your alibi right then and there. You know, and I would be throwing myself on my child, not caring what I did to the crime scene, if to save my child.
Right. And this whole thing about the fingerprints is going to come up again when we talk about her 911 call. But this is something that definitely struck him as strange. And it also struck him as strange that she didn't move. The other thing he testifies to is she didn't have a towel and it was pressed to her own neck. So she had a towel on herself. I mean, she was applying pressure to her neck to stop the bleeding, which you'd expect someone to do, but she doesn't seem to be taking any action to help the child. Now, you may think, well, the police officer probably just got it wrong, or he's biased, or he's trying to frame her. This is a railroad job, but he's not the only person that testified to this. Paramedic Colby, he of the fading light in Damon's eyes, who otherwise gave good testimony for Darlie, also testified that there was no towel on the boy's back when he entered the home. Now, why do the towels matter? Well, one reason they matter is because in her initial statement, she says she put a towel on the back. And she does this because she's wanting to show that she's helping her child. Because if she tried to murder them, why would she be trying to save them? Presumably, Damon knows who stabbed her. If he survives, he's going to be able to tell the authorities about that. But there's another thing that's important as well. She will later say, in addition to her initial story, she will add something, and that's that she went to the sink in the kitchen multiple times to get wet towels for the boys. Now, this is a contradiction of her statement to the police. She never mentions wetting the towels. The wet towels become important because there's evidence in this case that the crime scene was cleaned, and the explanation from Darlie and those who support her is that it wasn't actually cleaned. She was wetting these towels, and that's why it looked like it had been cleaned. So if there is no towel on Damon's back, then that's sort of a double blow for Darlie and for people who support her.
Okay, Brett, we've gone on for a while. Let's mention one more unusual aspect about the case for today before we wrap up. There's still so much more to talk about. Let's talk about the knives. Now, the murder weapon in this case was a butcher knife that came from a block in Darlie's kitchen. This points to the killer being someone from the home. People don't often enter a house to murder three people without a murder weapon. And there's also the whole knowing your way around a kitchen. Sure, many people have knives in a kitchen, but if you're coming in, time is of the essence. Normal people may hear something, wake up. You don't have time to search for a weapon. So it's very unusual to plan to murder multiple people with and enter a home without a weapon. Now, it's possible that this killer either didn't intend to murder anyone when he entered or liked using a murder weapon from the home. It's not common, but it could happen. More interesting is the knife used to cut the screen of one of the windows into Darlie's home. Investigators found another knife in the knife block, a serrated bread knife. When it was tested, it was found to have pigmented fiberglass rods and rubber dust in the grooves of the serrated knife. Charles Lynch, a forensic scientist, testified that he did 15 test cuts on an identical screen. He then evaluated these knives under a microscope. Each time, he found the exact same fiberglass particles and rubber dust as on Darlie's knife. Lynch attempted to find something else in the house that would have a similar combination, but found nothing. On cross-examination, the defense attempted to point to other possible sources of the fiberglass. Perhaps Darlie used the knife to cut open some packaging, but these would not have produced the same kind of fiberglass as the screen being cut. Moreover, the cut was consistent with a serrated knife. Lynch testified that the fibers were denuded in a more extreme fashion at the bottom of the cut than at the top, and this was consistent with someone withdrawing a serrated knife at that point. So think about how strange this is. Not only is the murder weapon from the knife block within the victim's home, but somehow you think that the screen is cut so that someone can crawl in through that screen. So in other words, they're cutting from the outside to come in, right? But a different knife than what was used to stab the boys and Darlie is used from the knife block to cut open the screen. But how can a knife from inside the house be used on the outside for the intruder to gain entrance into the home? And why would you take the knife, use it to cut a screen, put it back into the knife block, and use a different knife as a murder weapon? I mean, I'm posing, you know, these are rhetorical questions because it's all setting up a ridiculous situation. There's no way that a serrated knife from inside the house could have been used by an intruder on the outside to cut in order to gain access into the home. It seems that that knife was used from the inside to cut out.
We're leaving you on this note. I've got a little bit more I want to say about this knife and some of the testimony about this knife. To me, if you can't explain this, if you can't deal with this, then Darlie is guilty. Like, this piece of evidence alone is enough to convict her. That may seem strange to you, but it is often the case that one piece of evidence can be the piece of evidence that proves the crime. If there were a video of her doing it, for instance, the crime is proven, right? I mean, that's the most stark example that this person did it because they're on video doing it. Here, if it is true that this knife is the knife that cut the window screen, then she's guilty. There's just no question about it. Because the only way that window screen could have been cut and cut from the outside with this knife is if someone from inside the home did it. There's no reason for the intruder to do it. It doesn't even make sense. How would he even get access to this knife? If this is the knife, she's guilty. And I think it's worth sort of spending some time on this because of that. The defense, you know, they tried to say that the debris on the knife could have come from the brushes used to fingerprint items. You'll hear this a lot when you hear about this case. But Lynch testified, quote, "The fiberglass rods that make up these fingerprint brushes are almost twice as thick as the fiberglass in the screen. So they are very, very different. The fingerprint brush rods are much larger." The other problem is fiberglass wasn't found on any of the other knives in the block. So you have to imagine, number one, that they fingerprinted these knives, which is itself disputed, that when they fingerprinted them, the knives sort of naturally cut some of these fibers, and that's what he's seeing when he looks under the microscope. The problem is, it's not even close. I mean, these are much larger fiberglass rods on the brush. This is not the kind of thing you would just mistake. What this has led to, I think, is some confusion. It's been repeatedly stated that the same fingerprint brush was used to fingerprint the screen and the knife, thus possibly resulting in cross-contamination. This appears to either be a complete fabrication or a misunderstanding of the testimony regarding the fingerprint brush. In Darlie's initial appellant brief, which you can read on one of those various websites, her lawyers speculate that it's possible that cross-contamination happened sort of along these lines, but they don't actually offer any proof of it. They don't say, and we know that they used the same brush, because here's an affidavit where the guy says, "I brushed the screen, and then I walked over and I brushed the bread knife." Right? They don't have any of that. It's just sort of a speculative thing that they say could have happened. And it seems that this claim has largely fallen away from her actual defense. Now, people who support her say this all the time, but if you look at what she actually writes in her briefs, you don't see this. So if you look at Darlie's 2008 habeas petition, for instance, it calls for further testing of the rod that we found in the bread knife and repeats the claim that the rod itself could have come from the brush, but it makes no claim that the rod could have been the result of cross-contamination. And if you don't believe me, I will read you what they say. The jury never learned that before Lynch tested number four, knife number four, which is the knife, the kitchen knives recovered from 5801 Eagle Drive already had been dusted for fingerprints using a fiberglass brush composed of the same material as the fiber removed from the knife. No definitive tests were conducted to determine the source of the fiber. Lynch could testify only that the fiber was consistent with the garage screen window. He had reached a similar conclusion about a hair found in the same garage window screen that he opined was consistent with petitioner's hair. In fact, DNA testing determined that he was wrong. Interesting thing about this from the habeas petition, because the defense attorneys do two little tricks that you should always watch for. They're very common in this kind of thing, and you should just know that they're doing it. Number one, Lynch could testify only that the fibers were consistent with the garage screen window. That is actually all he could testify to. If you're an expert, you don't actually testify they were the same. You don't even do that with DNA. You don't say the DNA was the defendant's. You say it's one in, 15 billion people will have the same DNA.
You give it a probability that is near impossible it's anyone else's.
Exactly. So, you're essentially saying the DNA is consistent with the defendants and it's consistent with one other person on the planet, right? And you really want your experts to use this consistency language, because if they go too far, if they say it is the same fiber, then you do have a good chance of having that testimony caused your conviction to be overturned, because juries already put a lot of faith in experts. And if they are stating something that goes beyond what the science can actually show, that's a reason to overturn a conviction. So they're always going to say something like, it is consistent with blah, right? But defense attorneys use that fact to try and sort of cast doubt on their testimony. He didn't say it was the same. He just said it was consistent with. The second thing they do, which, this is fair play, but still not necessarily the same thing, is they say, and he messed up over here. He said the hair was consistent, and he was wrong. And since he was wrong about the hair, he must be wrong about the fiberglass. A couple things. Hair analysis, very difficult. Basically, nobody does it anymore because it's impossible to do it properly. Comparing two hairs, very different from the fiberglass rods on the brush are 10 times larger than the fiberglass rod we found on the knife. That's a very different thing, much easier distinction to make. Even if he's wrong about hair, it doesn't mean he's going to be wrong about the fiberglass rod. The other thing they say is no definitive tests were conducted. There were no definitive tests. It's a very small piece of fiberglass. Being able to definitively test it, it's not going to happen. What you're going to have to do is compare the two and see if they are similar and see if there's anything else that could cause that similarity. And that's why you have the testimony go the way that it did. So they make this argument in their habeas petition. They also have an expert affidavit, and he says, it is my opinion that if the knife number four was dusted using a brush and fingerprinting powder, and if the knives in the same block were also dusted using a brush and fingerprint powder, then it is possible that the fibers in knife number four came from the brush used to dust the knives in the kitchen rather than from the garage window screen. So, a couple things. Their argument is based on this affidavit. They're criticizing Lynch for only saying it's consistent, not saying it's definitive. Let me read that to you again. It is my opinion that if it was dusted and if the knives in the same block were also dusted, then it is possible that the fibers in number four came from the brush used to dust the knives. Even more speculative here, right? Basically, he is giving the barest limb to cling to if you're trying to say this rod came from the fingerprint brush and not from the screen.
That's a lot, Brett. I think what we've shown in these back and forths is it's so important to read and go back to the source rather than just take as lore what has become lore over time.
Right, because the cross-contamination thing is really important. And you will hear people basically just say, we can't trust that the bread knife evidence is legitimate because there was cross-contamination, which allows you, the great thing about cross-contamination is it allows you to accept the fact that that fiberglass rod came from that window and explain it. If you lose that, then you got to hope it's not the same rod, that it actually comes from this brush. Because otherwise, once again, how are you going to explain that? But the actual argument, even the argument of this expert in his affidavit, is not arguing cross-contamination. He's arguing that the fingerprint brush itself, not what was on it, not what it was used to brush, but that it itself is the source of this fiberglass rod. And I think that's going to be tough. And I don't know if this testing ever went through. We'll talk about this some more later. There's a lot of scientific testing that is ongoing in this case, but I would be interested to see if there was any further testing on this fiberglass rod. Well, look, we got a lot more to talk about in this case, a lot more evidence, a lot of evidence that may be supportive of Darley. We're going to talk about the sock that we mentioned earlier, which a lot of people point to as the strongest evidence in support of her, and just some other interesting things about this case as we sort of walk through the evidence that was put on at trial. This is another case where we're trying to really go through the testimony that the jury heard so you have a better understanding, even if you still disagree with them, about why the jury reached the conclusion it did. This is a very controversial case. I'm sure you already have thoughts. If you have any updates on that fiberglass rod, I'd love to hear it. Shoot us an email at prosecutorspod@gmail.com. Look us up on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at prosecutorspod. It's been so long since I've done this, I don't remember anymore. At prosecutorspod. Look us up on Reddit. We're on YouTube. We're all over the place. Come see us. Shout out to all you guys on Patreon. You are awesome. We've said it before, but we'll say it again. You're the best fans in the land, and we love you guys, and we hope you're enjoying this. But let us know what you think. We can't wait to hear from you. Well, Alice, do you have anything else you want to add before we sign off for today?
That's it. But there's so much more, and I'm so excited to keep digging into this case with you.
I am too, and we will be back to do that some more next week. But until then, I'm Brett.
And I'm Alice.
And we are the prosecutors. So I haven't drank anything since all this started. So this is my, like, 21st day without drinking. It's kind of crazy.
Is this like, I'm very proud of you? Or do you want to break it? That's like your offering? Your offering and suffering?
Start off is my offering and suffering, but now I kind of feel like it is.
Yeah. No, that's beautiful, though. That's really, really good, because I know how much you love drinking.
I know. Gotta take somebody, take me. You know, I'm fine. I'm ready to go. And then I was like, and I would even give up drinking. And it's like, I'm totally willing to die. If I have to stop drinking, I'll do that.
So. I'm glad you have your priorities today.